Thank you, Brother Mark. Good morning, brethren. Nebuchadnezzar is one of the most remarkable people in history. He's known historically for his rebuilding of the city and the nation of Babylon into tremendous splendor and glory. But that's not why we're interested in him. For the Bible student, his conquest of the southern portion of the kingdom of Judah and the destruction of Jerusalem is the focal point of Bible history. So that's where he fits in our minds. That included, of course, the destruction and plunder of Solomon's temple and the exportation of the Jews who lived there back to Babylon. This destruction and captivity was a significant punishment from God. And it resulted, as you know, from the corruption and idolatry that the Jews had fallen into. Nebuchadnezzar's army was the instrument that God used to punish the Jews for their idolatry and for being unfaithful. This is what we read in 2 Chronicles 36, verses 14 through 20, along those lines. It says, "Moreover, all the chiefs of the priests and the people trespassed very greatly after all the abominations of the nations, and they polluted the house of Jehovah, which he had hallowed in Jerusalem. And Jehovah, the God of their fathers, sent to them by his messengers, rising up early and sending, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. But they mocked the messengers of God and despised his words and scoffed at his prophets until the wrath of Jehovah arose against his people till there was no remedy. Therefore he brought upon them the king of the Chaldeans, who slew their young men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary and had no compassion upon young man or virgin, old man or hoary-headed. He gave them all into his hand. And all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of Jehovah, and the treasures of the king and of his princes, all these he brought to Babylon. And they burnt the house of God and brake down the wall of Jerusalem and burned all the palaces thereof with fire and destroyed all the goodly vessels thereof. And them that had escaped from the sword carried he away to Babylon, and they were servants to him and his sons until the reign of the kingdom of Persia." That is a terrible section of the Bible. Not because the Bible is terrible, but because of what prompted God having to do this to his people. After reading these verses, you think back of the good desires of some of the good servants of Israel. You think back on David and his pure desires of wanting to build a house of God so that the Israelites could come and properly worship him. Or you think back on the work of King Solomon, where he did the actual construction of the temple and all the wonderful building projects that he was involved in. And then you look at these verses and you see what a sad contrast to the previous glory of the kingdom of Israel. The previous works of David and Solomon were brought to ruin in these miserable events. And I was surprised to note that this was about 100 years, only 100 years after Solomon, that Israel was reduced to this point in these verses in Chronicles. Nebuchadnezzar was the instrument that God used to carry out the punishment of Judah. But you know, in Nebuchadnezzar's mind, his conquest of Israel had nothing to do with God. His aims were strictly political. So let's take a brief look at some of the information we know about this man, Nebuchadnezzar. As recently as 1956, a number of clay tablets were discovered in southern Iraq. They're called the Babylonian Chronicles. They document the history of Babylon from around 747 BC to 280 BC, a period of about 467 years. On the left there, you'll see a picture of one of the tablets that includes the period of Nebuchadnezzar in about the 600 BC area. Notice if you look closely, each entry on the tablet is separated by a horizontal line. That line begins the reign of a particular king that it's talking about. The first mention of Nebuchadnezzar describes his military actions as the general of his father, Nabopolassar. His father was victorious in battle, too. He had removed the yoke of Assyria on Babylon, and he even destroyed the capital city of Assyria, which was Nineveh. The Syrian capital was eventually reestablished in the fortified city of Carchemish on the western side of the Assyrian Empire. Carchemish was strategically located on an important trade crossing of the Euphrates. Now, we hear the name Mesopotamia all the time. Mesopotamia literally means between the rivers. You can see here why the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers were so important. They created that well-watered region that was the heart of what is known as the Fertile Crescent, and you can see the crescent shape that that makes there on the map. 3 years after the destruction of Nineveh, Nebuchadnezzar's father sent him against Carchemish in an attempt to gain control of that entire Mesopotamian region. When Nebuchadnezzar led his force against Carchemish, he was met by the Egyptian army, which had come up to help Assyria. In the battle for Carchemish, Nebuchadnezzar soundly defeated the Egyptians, and he destroyed Carchemish. Nebuchadnezzar then pursued the fleeing Egyptian army, and a second battle ensued at a place called Hamath, where he completely crushed them. And it's in this process that he conquered the entire region of Syria and Israel. So you see, Israel is in a larger context of what Nebuchadnezzar was doing. We focus on that, but for him, it was one little piece of the puzzle of conquering everything. It was on his way southward towards Egypt that he accepted the surrender of Jerusalem, and he took his first Jewish captives. He seized on this first time some of the elite citizens of Israel and brought them back to Babylon. In this first captivity, among them were the prophets Ezekiel, Daniel, and Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. As Nebuchadnezzar made his way down to Egypt to punish them for their support of Assyria, word came to him that his father died, and so he and a small contingent returned to Babylon to assume the throne. After this, there were two more times that Nebuchadnezzar came to Israel to deal with their continued revolts, until finally Jerusalem was destroyed and Zedekiah was taken captive. As punishment for his rebellious leadership, Zedekiah himself was treated with special harshness. His sons were killed as he watched, and then his eyes were put out. So the last thing he saw in his life was the murder of his sons. And Zedekiah eventually died in a Babylonian prison. Again, because of God's special dealings with the nation of Israel, these are some of the most significant events in history. But of all his accomplishments, Nebuchadnezzar took the most personal pride in the many building projects that he undertook, especially in the capital city of Babylon. Now, the city itself, the statistics vary widely because it's difficult to know some of these things so much later than they actually took place. Population estimates vary. One estimate is that there were up to 250,000 residents of the city of Babylon. Other estimates are in the millions, so it's difficult to know exactly. One historian who visited Babylon about a century after the death of Nebuchadnezzar, when the city was still in its decline stage, he still was able to say that it surpasses in splendor any city of the known world. This was 100 years after its zenith. The city of Babylon was truly a marvel. The Euphrates River ran right down the center of the city. Archaeologists say that ferry boats would take people across the river in the city, and Nebuchadnezzar even built a drawbridge 100 feet long and 30 feet wide. There was even a tunnel under the river that was 15 feet wide and 12 feet high. In the center of the city was a temple built to the god Marduk. In the outer court were two altars, one of solid gold, where animals were sacrificed, and frankincense was burned on these altars. Inside the temple was a sitting figure of Marduk made of pure gold, and before the figure was a solid gold table. What struck me about this whole thing when reading about this temple was its similarities to the use of Solomon's temple back in Israel. You know, it seems like whenever there's a true thing, Satan finds a way to make a counterfeit of it. Just as there's a nominal Babylon even existing today, it's a copy, a forgery of true Christianity. Even back in those days, there was a true worship of God centered in Israel in Solomon's temple. And here in this false one, we see almost a replica, an attempt to copy the pattern that God had established in the temple earlier. Another interesting feature is that in the time of Cyrus, who was the Persian king who overthrew Babylon, there are records of the existence of a giant statue in the court of this temple. The statue was reputed to be of a man and made of solid gold, having stood 18 feet high. Some people make the connection between this statue that Cyrus reported of and the image of Nebuchadnezzar that he required all to bow before. Remember, this was the image that Daniel refused to bow to and eventually led him to the lion's den. The city of Babylon also had two immense walls surrounding it. Again, there are different estimates on the thickness of the walls, anywhere from 25 to 70 feet thick. Now, when he was in power, Saddam Hussein ordered the reconstruction of some parts of ancient Babylon. Here's a reconstructed wall. Now, the lower third of this wall, you can almost make it out right above the archway, is original. It's the original Babylonian wall, and he had the rest built up. Now, the top of that archway you see there was actually the top of a 12-foot-high archway, so the rest of the wall is down below the ground. Here's another section of a wall rebuilt by Hussein. And here's part of Nebuchadnezzar's palace that he had rebuilt. And the next one is a shot from the ruins of another part of Nebuchadnezzar's palace. And in the distance, you can see something that I thought was interesting. It's the palace that Saddam had built for himself. His motivation, I don't think, was pure in any of this work. He thought, or he felt, that he was the next Nebuchadnezzar to build up Iraq like Nebuchadnezzar had built up Babylon. This is a shot from the ruins, like I said. And this is a wall mural recreated in Iraq depicting the ancient city of Babylon as it looked back then. Now, the height of the original walls is much greater than any of these reconstructions. On the right is a remnant of the original wall. It's been estimated that they were about 300 feet high, and the foundations of these walls extended 35 feet below ground. This wall was so massive that it was said that two chariots could drive side by side on top of the wall. Eight massive gates, each gate named after a god, allowed access through the outer walls. And then on the inner wall, access was allowed through 100 smaller brass gates. The outer wall was also surrounded by a deep moat, which in times of siege could be flooded by opening floodgates connected to the Euphrates. The main road into Babylon ran through the northwestern gate of the city. The gate was named after the god Ishtar, so it's the Ishtar Gate. Here's a picture of what the Ishtar Gate looked like. It was covered with dazzling blue tiles with winged lions of different colors embedded in the blue tile. The next slide is Saddam's recreation of the gate. Not too bad. Now, the roadway into the city was laid with huge flagstones, each with the inscription of Nebuchadnezzar. After entering through the Ishtar Gate, the main roadway opened into a huge square that ran southeast past all the major buildings. Archaeologists have named this Processional Way because of the parade during the 12-day New Year's Festival, which was Babylon's holiday. The city itself was a giant square. And, of course, estimates of the actual size of the city vary widely. Some say that it was actually up to 14 miles on each side. Another building worthy of note is the Palace of Nebuchadnezzar, which had in its corner the famous Hanging Gardens, one of the seven ancient wonders of the world. These gardens probably didn't actually hang in the sense of being suspended by cables or ropes. The name comes from the Greek word chrimastos, which means not just hanging, but overhanging, as in the case of a terrace or a balcony. This picture illustrates how the plants overhung the wall, so they were the overhanging gardens of Babylon. This ziggurat-like structure was covered with trees and flowers and had ferns and running water cascading down the sides. Archaeologists have actually uncovered an ancient hydraulic system that pumped water up from the Euphrates so that it could flow down. One Greek geographer wrote about the gardens in the first century B.C. He said it consisted of vaulted terraces raised one above another and resting upon cube-shaped pillars. These are hollow and filled with earth to allow trees of the largest size to be planted. The pillars, vaults, and terraces are constructed of baked brick and asphalt. A legend says that these gardens were built to please Nebuchadnezzar's queen Amytis, who was homesick for her mountains back in Media, which is presently Iran. So this may have been intended to look like a small mountain. Construction bricks that were used in all the building projects had the words stamped on them, which read, Nebuchadnezzar, the great king of Babylon. An amazing 90 to 95% of the bricks found from this time period bear that inscription. It's estimated some 15 million bricks were used by Nebuchadnezzar, and most of them with his name stamped on them. Beside the extensive work done in the city of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar constructed or restored almost every city and temple in the entire country. His inscriptions give an elaborate account of the immense work that he undertook. He built canals and aqueducts and reservoirs throughout the country, surpassing any similar work in history up to that time. In order to accomplish all that he did, he must have had the command of an enormous labor force. And I think that gives us an insight into why he needed to bring people of conquered nations back to Babylon. They were simply a cheap labor force for all his works. All his accomplishments abundantly illustrate the boast that he made in Daniel 4:30, when he said, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty?" Yes, brethren, by all worldly standards, Nebuchadnezzar was a truly great man. He was great in military conquests. He was great in building and construction. He was great in the management of people and a massive labor force that accomplished wonderful things. Through his planning and engineering leadership, Babylon was transformed into a rich, lush nation. In Daniel 4:4, he says, "I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in mine house and flourishing in my palace." In the midst of all this success and prosperity, Nebuchadnezzar's life was about to change dramatically. It started when God gave him a dream that troubled him and made him afraid. The fulfillment of that dream would affect him for the rest of his life. Let's read verses 10 through 17 of Daniel, the fourth chapter. "Thus were the visions of my head upon my bed. I saw, and behold, a tree in the midst of the earth, and the height thereof was great. The tree grew and was strong, and the height thereof reached unto heaven, and the sight thereof to the end of all the earth. The leaves thereof were fair, and the fruit thereof much, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field had shadow under it, and the birds of the heavens dwelt in the branches thereof, and all flesh was fed from it. I saw in the visions of my head upon my bed, and behold, a watcher and a holy one came down from heaven. He cried aloud and said thus, 'Hew down the tree and cut off its branches, shake off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the beasts get away from under it and the fowls from its branches. Nevertheless, leave the stump of its roots in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass and the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth. Let his heart be changed from man's, and let a beast's heart be given unto him. And let seven times pass over him. The sentence is by the decree of the watchers, and the demand by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth up over it the lowest of men." Now, in looking for an explanation of this dream, Nebuchadnezzar, of course, turned to Daniel. Daniel's reaction to this, I thought, was very interesting. In verse 19, we're told that upon hearing what the dream was, he was astonished for 1 hour, and his thoughts troubled him. When Nebuchadnezzar saw Daniel's reaction, Nebuchadnezzar tried to comfort him. In verse 19, addressing him by his Babylonian name, he says to Daniel, "Belteshazzar, let not the dream or the interpretation thereof trouble thee." Now, let's get the picture here. The king of Babylon, a heathen who controlled the known world, who worshiped false gods, is trying to comfort a Jewish man of faith who had been brought to Babylon as a captive, as a slave, as a servant. It's an amazing statement of the respect that Nebuchadnezzar had for Daniel, that he even cared that he hurt or he was sad. When it says that Daniel was astonished for an hour, we shouldn't take that to mean that it took him an hour to understand what the dream meant. I think Daniel knew immediately what was meant and what was going to happen. He was troubled because he was a loyal man, and he did not want to see Nebuchadnezzar have to go through that experience. He says to the king at the end of verse 19, "My lord, if only the dream applied to your enemies, and its meaning to your adversaries. You can just feel the compassion in the voice of Daniel as he says that to the king. He was deeply moved by what the dream meant. You know, that reaction of Daniel is very similar to Jesus in Matthew 23. Remember the experience when Jesus wept over the city of Jerusalem? He knew that God's judgment was that Jerusalem was going to be destroyed. But it pained the heart of Jesus knowing that his people were going to suffer and die and be taken away from their homes. Jesus didn't say, you know, Jews, it serves you right, even though it probably did. But he wept for the suffering that was coming. He was touched with sympathy. That's what Daniel was feeling. He didn't object to God's judgment. He didn't think that God was wrong for giving this dream, but he was pained in knowing what Nebuchadnezzar was going to have to endure. Brethren, that's a lesson for us. When we look at the world and all the evil that it does, we know what the Lord's judgments are. We know that the systems have to be destroyed so that the kingdom can come. But I think our hearts should be touched by the suffering and moved with the compassion, knowing what mankind is going to have to go through in Armageddon. Or even closer to home, in our personal lives, in our daily dealings with one another, when brethren endure hardships, even if they bring it on themselves through poor decisions or poor choices, I think our reaction should be like Daniel's. It shouldn't necessarily matter why something happens. When someone suffers, we should be touched by that. That's the heart that the Lord is looking for. Well, Daniel finally went on to tell the king that this vision was about him personally. In verse 22, he says, "You, O king, are that tree. You have become great and strong. Your greatness has grown until it reaches the sky, and your dominion extends to distant parts of the earth." So the tree itself pictured Nebuchadnezzar and his dominion in all its wealth and prosperity. It was a tree that provided shade and food for all those that lived beneath its branches. But things were not right with Nebuchadnezzar. In verses 24 through 27, Daniel elaborates further. He said, "This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree the Most High has issued against my lord the king. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like cattle and be drenched with the dew of heaven. Seven times will pass by you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and give them to anyone he wishes. The command to leave the stump of the tree with its roots means that your kingdom will be restored to you when you acknowledge that heaven rules. Therefore, O king, be pleased to accept my advice. Renounce your sins by doing what is right, and your wickedness by being kind to the oppressed. It may be that then your prosperity will continue." What a dream. But what was Nebuchadnezzar's reaction? How did he appeal? How did he react to Daniel's advice? Did he humble himself? Did he recognize the supremacy of God? Was he kind to the oppressed? Verse 28 suggests that that was not his reaction. It says, 12 months later, as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he said, "Is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty?" 12 months later, the Lord gave him time to repent of his sins, to change his arrogant attitude, and to recognize the supremacy of Jehovah. But you know, brethren, words and dreams are not always enough to change someone's attitude. We've learned so often in life that if a person doesn't want to change, nothing you say is going to make them change. They have to want it from within. What a blessing if people could learn from being told what is right. The permission of evil would have never happened if Adam would have learned that. All too often we have to go through the inevitable trial that comes from a refusal or an inability to learn from the wisdom of others. If Nebuchadnezzar had listened to Daniel, he could have avoided the awful experiences he was about to go through. Brethren, when I think of that, I think it makes me want to be more attentive so that I could learn from the wisdom that we're being told by the Lord and by the brethren. Well, you know, come to find out, Nebuchadnezzar's experience was not completely unique. There's a mental illness related to schizophrenia called lycanthropy, in which a patient believes that he is transformed into an animal and he behaves accordingly. Most likely, the Lord simply arranged this disorder of the brain to put Nebuchadnezzar into this animal-like state. But the principle that is being applied here is mentioned in Hebrews, the 12th chapter. It says, "No discipline seems pleasant at the time, but painful. Later on, however, it produces a harvest of righteousness and peace for those who have been trained in it or by it." 7 years of eating grass like an animal, being soaked with the morning dew, could not have been a very pleasant experience. But look at the harvest for a man who at one time failed to recognize the supremacy of God and thought that he himself was the center of the universe. Look at his attitude change in Daniel 4, 34 and 35. It says, "At the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified him who liveth forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the people of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back his hand or say, 'What have you done?'" Brethren, this is a harvest of righteousness for Nebuchadnezzar. This is a different man, isn't it? Gone is the arrogance and pride that filled his heart. He now acknowledged the supremacy of Jehovah and honored him and realized that his own dominion, even though at one point he thought it was grand, was really inconsequential. Men only rule by the permission of God. These were the things that God wanted him to learn. And God knew that he would, because in the dream the tree was not completely destroyed. The fact that the stump was left in place showed Nebuchadnezzar that after 7 times punishment, he would be allowed to reestablish his reign over Babylon. Now, even that fact I found interesting. Have you ever wondered why the Babylonians never looked for a successor? This man is out eating grass in the field. He's no threat anymore. Or at least find a substitute for the times that for his period of madness. I think there's only one answer, and that is the influence of Daniel and his 3 Hebrew friends. Think for a moment later, in the future, to a later time when the Roman Empire came into existence. History of that time is full of stories of how people lusted for power, how they lied and cheated and murdered to become the emperor. And here, a world power waited for 7 years without a king, and when he returned, there was no conflict, no dissension, no need to reassert himself militarily. Brethren, I think only by the Lord's Spirit manifested through Daniel could that have possibly happened. Well, for Nebuchadnezzar, it was a truly humbling experience, especially for a man in his position, and after all the things that he had done to make himself famous. Part of the humbling was the fact that everyone in Babylon would come to know what happened to this great man. All his conquests, all his magnificent building projects became secondary to a man who became an animal. Jesus said something important and very relevant to this story in Luke 18:14. He said, "For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." Nebuchadnezzar exalted himself in his words, not just in his words, but by his works and by the wars that he fought. When he was boasting about his accomplishments, remember what he said, "It was for the glory of my majesty that I did it." The Apostle Paul draws a stark contrast to that attitude in Philippians 2, verses 3 through 10. He says, "Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who, being in God's form, yet did not meditate a usurpation to be like God, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And being in condition as a man, he humbled himself, becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, every knee should bow. So the contrast here is plain, isn't it? Nebuchadnezzar had to be humbled by God, humiliated by God. Jesus humbled himself. And no matter what humiliating experiences came through being a man, he accepted them as God's will. That's our pattern. And that's one of the key lessons in the story of Nebuchadnezzar. Well, let's get a little practical here, brethren. And I think we can talk about this for hours, and I think it would be helpful to examine it further. But the question is, how can we gauge, if we're doing a self-examination, our humility pride factor, I'll call it? How do we know if we have the right attitude that's pleasing to the Lord? One of the results of having a humble heart is the practice of submission. In some ways, I think submission is a little easier to measure than saying, how humble am I? Submission plays a key role in the way we look for the Lord's direction in our lives. In the context of a father disciplining his children, Paul says in Hebrews 12:9, when we were children, we had fathers who corrected us, and we respected them for it. Can we not much more readily submit to the discipline of the Father of men's souls and learn how to live? I love that description of God, that he is the Father of men's souls. He knows how to create a perfect heart in each and every one of us. He knows how to develop in us the fruits and the graces of the Spirit. And he's given us many, many guidelines for us to follow. Our job is to submit to those guidelines. There are so many principles that God has given us. He didn't expect us to figure this all out on our own, but he gave us guiding principles to look for. And I can come up, and I'm sure you can, with 100 examples. Let me give you one. When the scriptures tell husbands to love their wives, to watch out for them, to nurture them, to become one with them, submitting to that guidance will mean that we will take those principles seriously and work on them and find ways to apply them in our everyday lives. You know, even when our wives are making mistakes and are not perfect in every circumstance, too many people, too many brethren, give up on those principles because things are just not working out. Another example is when the Lord tells us to forgive one another. It's a very basic, fundamental principle. Our humble submission to that command will make us maybe look inward and find the brethren that maybe we're holding a grudge against and say to ourselves, you know, Tom, the Lord wants me to forgive them. That's a guiding principle he's given me. And if I want to submit to him, I will do everything in my power to remove any animosity that I feel. Brethren, that is submission. And that's the working of humility in real life. It becomes tangible, something we can work with, and not just a nebulous definition in life. Everything we do should be motivated by the lesson that God taught Nebuchadnezzar, to honor God, to recognize him as supreme, and for us to submit ourselves willingly to the principles that he's given us in his word. Sometimes they're hard to do. They fight against human nature. But the rewards are absolutely tremendous and worth the effort. The prophet Micah gave us a simple philosophy that should be part of the theme of our lives. He said, he has showed you, O man, what is good. What does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Nebuchadnezzar violated each of those principles by his pride and lack of kindness. He certainly wasn't one to love mercy, at least before his ordeal. In looking at the details of the humbling of Nebuchadnezzar, we see another wider application. Brother Russell writes, this remarkable tree, in its glory and beauty, represented the first dominion of earth given to the human race in its representative and head, Adam, to whom God said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. The original glory of man and the power invested in him was indeed sublime, and were over the whole earth to bless and feed and protect and shelter every living thing. But when sin entered, the command came to hew down the tree, and the glory and beauty and power of mankind were taken away, and the lower creation no more found shelter, protection, and blessing under its influence. Death hewed down the great tree, scattered his fruit and foliage, and left the lower creation without its Lord and benefactor. So the tree also represents the dominion of man through Father Adam. Notice the similarity we see in the description of the tree in Daniel 4:12 to Adam's dominion in the Garden of Eden. Daniel 4:12 says, "Its leaves were beautiful, its fruit abundant, and on it was food for all. Under it the beasts of the field found shelter, and the birds of the air lived in its branches. From it every creature was fed." So just as Nebuchadnezzar's pride led to the fall, so pride played a part in the fall of man. Remember how Satan suggested to Eve that if she ate the forbidden fruit, they would become like God? Eve believed that statement, and she gave to Adam, and they ate the forbidden fruit together. The desire to be like God was the root of disobedience, and that desire, I believe, stemmed from pride. It's an interesting detail in the story. After Adam and Eve sinned, it says that they hid themselves from God because they were naked. In verse 11, God said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten of the tree that I commanded you not to eat from?" You see the connection that God is making there? He's connecting the shame of their nakedness with their disobedience. Pride led to disobedience. Therefore, pride brought them to their naked condition. This is illustrated in the Lord's words to the Laodicean church in Revelation 3:17. Remember how he condemns that church? He says, "Because thou sayest, I am rich and increased with goods and have need of nothing, and knowest not that thou art wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked." From God's standpoint, we are naked if we feel that we are self-reliant and exclude him from our lives and our decision-making. Humility and submission, on the other hand, lead to the promises of God found in Psalms 91:4. God promises that he shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings shalt thou trust. His faithfulness shall be thy shield and buckler. So being truly clothed, in God's estimation, is a picture of the security and the safety of living under the Father's care. It's a place of refuge that we have because of our covenant relationship with him. It's also our submission to the principles that he has given us to live by. Nebuchadnezzar's pride led him into the field to dwell with the beasts. He lost the security of his kingdom and of his army and of his wealth. Nebuchadnezzar was naked, without divine protection, all because he failed to recognize the Most High and humble himself and submit himself to divine authority. Adam, likewise, was naked, in more than a physical sense. By being cast out of the garden, he lost the security of its protection. He lost the special place of living under the shadow of the Almighty. The punishment for Nebuchadnezzar lasted for 7 years. For 7 years, he lived like a wild animal. Instead of 7 years, man's experience of alienation, of being in a beast-like condition, will last 7,000 years. It really won't be until the end of the millennium that man will be fully restored and have his dominion returned to him. This beast-like condition is such an appropriate way to describe what has happened to man since the fall. Pride creates a heart of stone, a heart that has no mercy, no compassion for its fellow man, a heart that has one aim in life, and that is the advancement of self. That's the animal code. It's the survival of the fittest. That is not God's way. But just as God left a stump of the tree, he's promised that things will change. Once the brass and iron bands are removed, the stump could grow back. Now, brethren, this is a miracle. I don't know a lot about trees, but I think if you cut down a large tree right to its base, it's not going to grow back by itself. It just stays a stump. And so the fact that this stump of a tree could grow back really is a picture of divine intervention. It's a miracle that that tree was able to grow back. And speaking of the Lord's second advent, you remember what Peter said in Acts 3. He says, God shall send Jesus Christ, which before was preached unto you, whom the heavens must retain until the times of restitution of all things, which God hath spoken by the mouth of all his holy prophets since the world began. You know, the fact that God would speak of restitution by the mouth of all his holy prophets shows us how much restitution means to God himself. Restitution is the focal point of God's plan. He will restore man's dominion of the earth. And we're told that in the kingdom, man's heart of stone will be taken away, and he will be given a heart of flesh. You see that transformation in Nebuchadnezzar too. The purpose of everything that has happened since the fateful day when Adam and Eve were cursed and expelled from paradise is mirrored in what Nebuchadnezzar learned from this experience. Remember his wonderful words when he said, I praise the Most High. I honored and glorified him who liveth forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the people of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases with the powers of the heaven and of the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back his hand or say, what have you done? The permission of evil has been to teach mankind these simple truths. What monarch who has ever reigned on earth can do for mankind what God can do? What human being has the ability to raise the dead, heal the sick, bless the poor? Brethren, someday man is going to wonder, what took us so long to recognize the goodness of our Creator? That humility will finally create the tender heart that God has wanted, full of mercy and good fruits. Just as having that tree grow back was not a natural thing, so earthly restitution is not natural. It's not the natural course of events. The natural course of events for us is death. Restitution requires miracle after miracle, and they're happening in our day. Only by God's intervention can restitution happen. But God's hand is not short because he really wants it to happen. In examining what man's dominion will entail, I'm sure that we do not fully comprehend what God has designed for the earth. Remember that dominion included dominion of the animal kingdom. In that connection, Brother Benjamin Barton, I thought, made a very interesting statement. He says, what marvelous things Jesus did. He had dominion over the beasts of the field. He could ride an ass's colt up to Jerusalem. Jesus had more power over the colt than its mother did. It had never been ridden before, but Jesus had no trouble with it. And the crowd strewed palm branches in the way. A young colt that had never been ridden would gladly have run away because that strange man was on its back. On another occasion, when they had been fishing all night and had caught nothing, he told them to cast their net on the other side. They did so with wonderful success. Jesus had dominion over the fish of the sea. This shows something of the power of a perfect man. I like that. I think there's something to that. And I wonder how far man's dominion will extend. Let me just share the words of a camp song that a lot of the kids sing together. And sometimes in the simple phraseology of kids' things, there are some deep truths. This song is titled, The Kingdom Just for You. And if you want to hug a grizzly bear, go right ahead. Don't be afraid. This is the kingdom that he made just for you. And you can talk to strangers. Be their friend. Won't need the keys to lock your door. Won't have to visit doctors anymore. And if you couldn't walk, you'll run all day. And you'll laugh if you couldn't see. Because eagles won't have eyes half as good as yours will be. This is the kingdom just for you. And if you never met your mother's mother's mom, you'll meet her then, like she was before. And you won't have to say goodbye anymore. And you'll get to know the Lord as your best friend. You'll know it's true that he loves you. And his love doesn't have an end. This is the kingdom just for you. Restitution, earthly dominion, serving the Lord out of abundant hearts, that will be the rebirth of the fallen tree called mankind. A tree whose latter splendor will be greater than its original glory ever was, because it will have learned its need for God. Brethren, there's a third application to this dream that we'll cover very quickly. When we hear the phrase seven times in connection with Nebuchadnezzar, we also think of the seven times mentioned in Leviticus 26. Remember, after many warnings to Israel, God finally says, "If you will not hearken unto me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins. And I will break the pride of your power, and I will make your heaven as iron and your earth as brass. And I will send wild beasts among you, which shall rob you of your children and destroy your cattle and make you few in number, and your highways will be desolate." This prophecy ties directly into Nebuchadnezzar because, as we said right at the beginning, he was the instrument that God used to punish Israel. We don't have time to get into this. You can read this all in the third volume. But remember in Daniel, the seventh chapter, the four universal empires, beginning with Babylon, are described from God's standpoint as destructive animals. There was the lion with wings, the bear with three ribs in its mouth, the third, the leopard with four heads and four wings, and the fourth, a terrible beast that he almost couldn't describe, but it had teeth of iron and had 10 horns. These, we know, are pictures of the four universal empires of Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Now, the point back in Leviticus 26 is that these wild animals would cause Israel to be desolate and to rob her and to punish her. The seven times mentioned there are a picture of the length of time that would be permitted. We know it can't be seven literal years because this had to extend much greater. They had many punishments that were short, but this was seven times added to all those smaller punishments. And so seven times here we think are seven 360-year periods. So 7 years times seven times 360 days, a day in a year, 360 days in a year, I'm sorry. There are 2,520 days in 7 years. And so we see a correspondence to the 2,520 years of Gentile rule, ending in 1914 with the advent of World War I. This period of punishment is referred to by Jesus in Luke 21:24, when he says, "Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles shall be fulfilled." It began with the desolation of Israel by Babylon, and it ended in 1914, when World War I began the sequence of events that brought the return of Israel as a nation, no longer under Gentile control. Brethren, Israel is one of the modern-day miracles that, again, can only be explained by God's divine intervention. So the lessons from Nebuchadnezzar's experience are both prophetic and they're to the heart. We see three applications to the remarkable dream that God gave him. First of all, to Nebuchadnezzar himself. It was the humbling of a proud king. We might call it a reality check for him. He learned how unimportant he was in the real scheme of things, and he learned to acknowledge God. A larger application is to mankind. We see a picture of restitution and the similar lessons that mankind is learning through the permission of evil. And finally, we see a picture of the Gentile times as they were used to punish Israel for seven prophetic times, or 2,520 years. For ourselves, brethren, we see the lesson of humility and the importance of submitting ourselves to the will of God, to the principles of God, to the guiding examples that he gave us in scriptures, not to let any of them go, but to pay special attention to every principle of conduct and growth that he's given to us. Pride is our enemy, and one that can keep us from living under the shadow of the Almighty. When all these lessons are learned, God's final design will be put into place. Then cometh the end, when he shall have delivered up the kingdom to God, even the Father. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death.